For coming, I requested an indulgence to go first because I sort of double booked myself and have to get on a plane. So I think this is conceptually a little bit out of order, and I appreciate being able to go first because I think most of the other talks are going to be somewhat upstream of the policy process, looking at laws and regulations and their impact on public health, although that's my area of interest, and I was a regulator at OSHA for 6 or 8 years. I'm in this project working on sort of downstream enforcement of existing regulations. And really the basic notion here, I want to acknowledge my colleagues at Penn, Richard Burke, who's a criminologist and a statistician. I'm in the first slide, Carrie Colonese, who's my co-director at the law school, and Ted Emmett, who's an octoc at Penn Medical School. I'm going to go quickly over a problem statement for people who are not so familiar with the public health problems in the workplace, but I just want to quickly get to the bottom line of the project. This is we're still in our first year, but the basic notion is, can the same kind of statistical profiling, sort of evidence-based algorithms for looking at the same way local police forces look at characteristics of potential offenders and try and deploy their resources more efficiently, can that be transferred to a regulatory agency, in this case OSHA, but I think eminently transferable to EPA, FDA, Aviation Administration, others who have all the same problem of scarce inspection resources and an overwhelming problem, probably nowhere more acute than OSHA, which has about 2,000 people on the ground for over 8 million workplaces. So they'll never get to them all, and they have to get to the right ones quickly. Very basic inspection problem. And the goal of this project is to see whether that can be done more effectively through profiling. Problem statement, I'm going to go very quickly through some of these, but they're available through me, and I'll give you my email address. But I think some very bright, sensitive people are shocked at the magnitude of occupational safety and health as a public health problem. Nicholas Kristof from the New York Times, who writes about public health issues globally, wrote with great passion and indignation about the occupational fatality rate among prostitutes, which can be as high as about 2%. And I wanted, this was an unpublished letter, but wanted to make the point that that would put them somewhere around number 6 to 8 in the litany of fatal occupational accident rates, which go up to nearly 6% per lifetime among commercial fishers, and which at the time I wrote this, there was a recent OSHA health standard, which mission accomplished after the regulation allowed a lifetime risk of 2.5% from lung cancer among chromium workers. So 2% is a terrible lottery to enter when you go into the workplace, but it's by no means uncommon. So there are about 5,000 to 6,000 occupational fatalities every year. It's been coming down, but of course, as anything with an asymptote will do, it's harder to get that number down to zero as you get towards a lower number. But 5,000 to 6,000 is not a small amount, and it is dwarfed by the problem of occupational illness. This is an attributable risk study, but it's been replicated by other groups to suggest that probably 40 to 60,000 premature deaths occur from chronic exposures in the workplace. That would put that somewhere around number 8 as the leading cause of death from all causes in the country. The statistics, as people know, are just human stories with the tears wiped away. Here is Patrick Walters, a 21-year-old who was written about in a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times series in 2003. He did not want to go into an unsafe trench. He told his employer it didn't look good. His employer allegedly said, if you don't go in, don't bother coming to work tomorrow. I'm not going to dwell on this very grisly slide, but this was in the Times. This is what happened to Patrick later that day in 2002. And this happens whether it's a trench or struck by or falling off electrocutions. This happens, again, about 6,000 times a year somewhere in the country. The health side is, of course, even worse. This is a quick notion of common industrial solvent out in the environment outside this building. The range is in the parts per trillion. Inside the workplace, this is recently regulated substance, so it's a better picture than most. Inside the workplace, the concentrations are parts per million. And OSHA used to take a reasonable number of samples a year, now it's taking far fewer. And so we know more about what Rover and Kitty are breathing and ingesting and leaving in their bodies than we do about what workers are. Well, I don't know if I have even 40 seconds to show a little embedded video, and I don't think I will do it with the time constraint, but there would be a video there of an actual, not just a YouTube, but an actual commercial for Mike's Hard Lemonade that shows a worker falling off a second level, being impaled by a rebar, and going to the bar to have a drink to ease the pain. That is apparently an acceptable topic for humor, whereas my point is that you would never in this day and age imagine a commercial about some environmental problem of similar magnitude. So the mismatch problem is huge. This is a slide from the AFL-CIO about the depending on the state and the number of inspectors, somewhere between 20 and 100 years for any random workplace to be inspected even once. One key distinction at OSHA is that about two-thirds of the inspections are so-called program, that is targeted inspections, where the goal is to actually go randomly and find the places that are most likely to be causing harm and in violation of standards. The others are so-called unprogrammed. Those are complaint inspections where a worker will ask for OSHA's presence where there's already been an accident or a fatality, and a couple of other small categories. So about two-thirds of them are sort of intentionally deployed. And the criterion that OSHA has always used for this is the self-reported injury rate in the workplace. And so that raises at least three questions. Are the rates accurate? I think the answer is pretty clearly no. Is even accurate past history of injury really the best proxy for current and future propensity to cause conditions that are going to result in grave harm? And then, again, it's ignoring the illness and chronic question altogether. I want you to remember this slide in a few minutes when I come back at the end. I'm going to look at some data preliminarily from it's going to be calendar year 2009, not fiscal, but OSHA says that about 25% of its inspections now are so-called clean inspections where they don't find any evidence of violative conditions. Is that too high a number? It's sort of a judgment call, but I'm going to show I think that number is underreported by OSHA. So again, the research questions are, do characteristics of firms other than this 30-year experiment with going to deploy inspectors based on the self-reported injury rate, might there be other characteristics that correlate better with the number and severity of workplace safety and health hazards? And could an algorithm reduce the inefficiency of this system? There are lots of ways to measure it, but I think there's one obvious way to measure half the inefficiency. The so-called false positives would be these in-compliance inspections. If 25%, or as I will argue, 50% of all the programmed inspections result in going to essentially the best workplaces, that's a missed opportunity to deploy people where they might be more useful. False negatives are a little harder to pin down. It's sort of a counterfactual, but what we're going to be looking at is looking at inspection data from a recent but not a current year, and then looking forward in the database to see if firms were not visited in 1 year that a year or two later suffered at least one fatal accident. So that arguably is a missed opportunity to have gone somewhere in time to notice conditions that then somewhat soon thereafter led to a fatality. Indebtedness to some people who've come before, but I don't think anyone's really tried to do it quite this way. I just wanted to mention a former colleague of mine at OSHA, Mike Silverstein, was quoted just a few months ago on a radio broadcast saying pretty much what we're saying, that they discover hazards only half as often as they should, as an indicator that we're not getting people to the right places at the right time. And so what we're going to be doing is taking the complete database, about 30 years of data, about 8 million records of violation organized by inspection, and then begin to build up this database with other characteristics of the firm-level characteristics that were ongoing at the time of these inspections. OSHA has a built-in system that I think is actually pretty good for evaluation. The severity or the gravity of what they're finding is, I think, well measured by the initial amount of the dollar penalty. That is before, all of the reductions are given for good faith and settlement discussions and being blackmailed into giving people less of a fine. But if you start with the initial fine, it's already based on the gravity of the harm and, of course, the number of violations. If you have 70 things going on that are wrong, the fine will be greater. The basic theoretical algorithm that comes from criminology, here's another example that my colleague Dick Burke did, but what he does at the local level, again, we're trying to do at the national level going forward, if someone picks up the phone at the police department, Dick's algorithm says when you've looked through data on lots and lots of domestic violence screening calls and you match them up with where things really went wrong when the police didn't get there quickly enough to intervene, that if someone has already been the victim has already called three or more times, that's a red box. You better get out there. If it's the first or second call, if the alleged perpetrator is unemployed and has at least one report of destroying property when angry, that's a red flag and you should go. And if the person's employed and then also has made a direct threat of violence in the past. So we're going to be trying to do that for not a criminal issue necessarily, but are these firms evidencing red flags of propensity to do harm? So I just want to show a couple of very preliminary results real quickly just to make the point that we've been trying to look at sort of how bad is the problem. So I've looked at calendar 2009, about 100,000 inspections, and if you look at the boldface numbers in the fourth row here, OSHA sees about three times the average gravity of problems when it goes in response to complaints as when it goes in on its own program system. And that about 50% of the program inspections, and unprogrammed as well, are either in compliance with no violations at all, as OSHA says, or the dollar penalty is zero. So even though they were so-called not in compliance, whatever was found was so trivial that the penalty, even before the reduction, was zero. So I think there are at least half of all these inspections, nothing of consequence is found. Now, just going back for 10 more seconds, some of the things we're going to be looking at are other violations. We're going to try and merge together the OSHA and the EPA databases to see that if history of violating EPA norms is a red flag for OSHA. Looking at financial information like debt equity ratios and credit rating, and then looking for some so-called white flags that might, in the algorithm, predict away from needing to inspect, like being recommended by socially responsible funds, being on some list of green companies. I will just close with a quote. This is from the head of OSHA in the early 2000s, John Henshaw. He came in late 2001 and immediately said, "I'm full of vim and vigor. I want to have OSHA be the leader, change the national dialogue." And within a month of his leaving, 4 years later, he said, "It's impossible. Nothing can be done." Now, David Michaels is a very different person. I worked for John Henshaw, and I know David well. John, I think, could well have said, not that it's impossible, but I chose not to try or I was unsuccessful. We hope that David, who is clearly trying, will be successful. We hope that this effort will be of help to him. Thank you. Thank you.
Since Adam has to take a couple of questions, the rest of the presentation is the questions at the end. So, are there any questions for Adam?
Chromium why we have workers still exposed, what the solution is. Obviously, a regulation isn't going to work. What do you do when you don't have kids at the standards to measure something?
Well, boy, that calls for a long answer, which I will not be given time to give you. But I'm not that pessimistic. I mean, I think the agency has done a terrible job and has failed utterly at everything it has tried. But the internal excuse that there are too many analytic hurdles, there's too little money, that, you know, Congress is always making it hard. You know, to me, we were both there. I think that those are excuses that could be not easily overcome, but they could not be uttered anymore, and the people inside could just get to business and try and do better. I think that before we get to all these new regulations, I'm actually working at any regulations, but I think one of my interests is in occupational exposure limits that might not be mandatory, but that would be informative, and we don't even have those. We have environmental limits, but not occupational. And no one I've talked to, from David Michaels to the heads of AIHA and ACGIH to industry, want these limits promulgated or even created. So it's a massive national failure of will and caring about this issue.
One more? All right,
well, I didn't show the acknowledgement slide, so thank you to Robert Wood Johnson, and here is my phone and email if you want to especially send any ideas for how we might profile better. Thank you.